Welcome to another episode in season 5 of Tenement Yard Media's Checkmate, or political podcast. I am your host for this episode, Clifford James. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Tenement Yard Media _ to keep up to date with our latest episodes and blogs. As you can tell by the title of this episode, we'll be discussing the new IMF's Resilience and Sustainability Facility. Barbados and Jamaica has been the first two Caribbean countries to access this fund, and amongst the first in the world. But when this fund was announced, there was a range of emotions. Some supported it, and some fundamentally opposed the move. Here to break this down is Dr. Delano D'Souza, Lecturer of Economics at the University of the West Indies, Cavill Campus. Dr. Delano, welcome to the yard.
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me. It's my privilege to be with you today.
The pleasure is all ours. Fun fact, actually, Dr. Delano is also the co-host of a podcast, a lawyer and a policy analyst walk into a bar with attorney at law, Jadwick Cummings. So when the listeners are finished here, stop by their podcast. I can assure you, it's quite interesting. I think the most recent episode was about social insecurity. The name was kind of funny to me. I don't know why. But yeah, without further ado, let's get right into today's episode. So Dr. D'Souza, could you expound on what exactly is the IMF's Resilience and Sustainability Facility, RSF for short?
Sure. Well, the IMF Resilience and Sustainability Facility, the RSF, like you said, the idea was really born amid a decision by the IMF, if you would remember, during the COVID-19 pandemic, to inject, which is what is the equivalent of around $650 billion of reserve assets known as special drawing rights, SDRs, into the global economy, really with the aim of helping countries to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic, the economic, health, and other implications thereof. So by default, the SDRs are allocated to countries proportionally to the size of their economy, which means richer countries receive much more of the support than poorer countries. So lower-income countries only get around $21 billion of that $650 billion, which I spoke about. So the RST now, the RSF, is really meant to amplify the effect of that allocation of special drawing rights, because it's aimed at channeling resources from economically stronger members to countries where the needs are greatest, which are the developing countries. So the aim is really to provide longer-term financing to strengthen economic resilience and sustainability by supporting policy reforms that reduce macro-critical risk associated with climate change and pandemic preparedness. Of course, it came out of the COVID-19 pandemic. And also to augment the policy space and financial buffers to mitigate the rising costs associated with and the structural challenges surrounding climate change in general. So the RSF will provide policy support and relatively affordable in these times. longer maturity financing with a 20-year maturity and around a 10 and a half year grace period in terms of repayment of the principal, which could be very handy, particularly for countries like ours with limited fiscal space, to help build resilience against long-term risks, to balance of payment stability. Also, about 3/4 of the IMF country membership is eligible for the RSF funding, and including low-income members as well as most middle-income countries. And that's one of the important elements of the RSF, because it provides the eligibility for some of these countries that otherwise would not have qualified. Now, the eligible countries, when requesting access to the fund, to the facility, the difference with this now compared to some of the other funds or some of the other facilities available through the IMF is that you're supposed to have a high quality policy reforms addressing the long-term structural challenges of climate change and pandemic preparedness. So you're supposed to have some sort of framework in place. However, the challenge is, of course, because you're trying to make this particular facility accessible to lower income countries, there had to be some changes in terms of how the structure, how they would have envisaged it from the beginning. So how was it being financed? We mentioned before about the special drawing rights. So really how it's been financed more or less so far is that the resources of these SDRs are being mobilized based on voluntary contributions from IMF members with strong external positions. In other words, the IMF has issued these special drawing rights to developed and developing countries alike. However, the developed countries may not necessarily need to draw on these SDRs immediately. So what they're doing is that they're channeling some of these SDR for the benefit of low income countries. So in other words, it's a reallocation and providing them through the RSF so that low and middle income countries and developing countries can benefit from it. So that's the crux of it. And the conditionality, of course, because it's the IMF, the conditionality, of course, is linked to reform progress. So each measure is supposed to be connected to one RSF disbursement. And a reform measure can be a single policy action or a set of very closely related action, which would then be considered as a single reform. And of course, when it comes to climate change resilience and sustainability, you'd recognize there now that a lot of these measures are linked in terms of the policies and the projects. So if you didn't allow for that sort of that sort of linkage, then it might be difficult in terms of the disbursement. So that's basically what the RSF is in short.
Oh, okay. And just for people who don't know how these like programs work, is it that the countries go to IMF and say, hey, we need money? And then IMF gives them the money and say, these are all the terms or conditions, or the countries meet with IMF representatives and they work out some conditions regarding the money or the loans that they will take on?
Well, in terms of the relationship between the IMF and member countries, as you, well, as most of our listeners will know, we usually, the one that we know about most is the Article 4 review. When the IMF, the annual Article 4 review, where the IMF comes into the country and holds discussions and evaluates the economy, gives recommendations and speaks to what is happening in the economy generally. Now, based on that, the IMF obviously has a working understanding of how the economies are progressing and the policies and so on, and of course, the relationships with the government as well. Now, when a country wants to gain access to a particular fund, whether it is an extended fund facility, which we'll get to in a minute, and so on, they would then approach the IMF. I mean, things have changed, and I think we'll speak about this a little bit later as well. Things have changed in terms of how the IMF engages with its member countries. It's now more of a collaboration in many respects in the discussions. So, but it is something where the countries do approach the IMF, and then the discussions begin specifically as it pertains to access to those funds and the terms. And so, of course, there are certain guidelines within which the terms are set based on the particular facility. But by and large, the country would approach the IMF for access, and then those conversations will begin. There are other funds, for example, such as the SDR, which are, those sort of facilities are available and they're allocated to countries. It's just a matter of when the countries would like to draw down on those resources.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that. So recently, Jamaica's finance minister, Dr. Nigel Clark, was promoting this new catastrophe bond. Are they in any way, shape, or form similar to this RSF?
Well, the catastrophe bond is different. The catastrophe bond, and we have to say kudos to Jamaica for being the first Caribbean country to embark on an independently floated catastrophe bond, if you want to put it like that. But basically, what the cat bond is, it's similar to an insurance policy. The cat bond, it's basically an instrument that allows the issuer, in this case Jamaica, to receive funding from the holders only under specific conditions, such as, for example, if a natural disaster, a hurricane hits Jamaica, after knock on wood, God forbid, that were to happen, then they would have access to the funding from the cat bond. So it's significantly different from the RSF facility, because the RSF facility is meant to build in resilience ahead of time, whereas this bond, it's similar. It's supposed to supplement what we know as the Caribbean Catastrophe Risk Insurance Facility, which is basically triggered when there is a natural disaster or a natural event that causes loss to the particular country in question. So they're not the same. Again, because the cat bond is triggered when something specific happens, whereas the RSF is meant to promote climate change and resilience and adaption ahead of time on an ongoing basis. So, for example, if Jamaica is never hit, and we would all love that, if Jamaica is never affected in under the terms of the cat, then it will not access those funds.
So it's a good thing to have both of them, I would say, or you would say.
Yes, it would be. It's definitely a good thing to have, and it's becoming best practice. If we look at what the Caribbean Catastrophe Risk Insurance Facility brings, we've seen a lot of disbursements, over multi-million dollar disbursements, even last year to Trinidad and other countries when they're hit. Not just that, the facility allows disbursement of millions of dollars based on the policy, of course, within the space of a few days. And of course, if your country is hit by a disaster, access to that sort of resources in the immediate aftermath is critical.
Yes. So as we know, Jamaica and Barbados are the first two Caribbean countries to access this fund or facility. However, they also received two additional funding, the precautionary and liquidity line in terms of Jamaica and the extended fund facility in relation to Barbados. Could you explain the differences between these programs here?
Sure. Well, I in terms of what we know as the Caribbean, we're usually told that we've started to become accustomed to hearing about the standby arrangements and so on with the IMF. But of course, the PLL, the Precautionary Liquidity Line, and of course the EFF, which Barbados has now entered into its second consecutive extended fund facility arrangement with the IMF, they're significantly different from the RSF. So the Precautionary Liquidity Line, the PLL, is designed to meet the liquidity needs of the member countries with sound economic fundamentals, but with some remaining vulnerabilities which preclude them from using another facility, which is the Flexible Credit Line, the FCL, which is only available to countries with very strong policy frameworks and track records of economic performance. In other words, if you don't qualify based on your economic fundamentals for the Flexible Credit Line, then you would fall down and you would have access to the precautionary and liquidity line. Now, in addition obviously now this is different because in terms of the PLL, it's a good sign that for example, Jamaica has gained access to the PLL, because if you listen to how it's described, it's described as when you have sound economic fundamentals, but you have some small vulnerabilities, yeah? So if it were a situation where Jamaica had larger vulnerabilities that the IMF would have flagged, they would not have had access to the PLL, for example. So it's taken as a sign that the economy of Jamaica is progressing well, the fact that they have been able to access the PLL, for example. Yeah. So in addition to the generally positive assessment of the country's policies with respect to the artful consultations, which we mentioned earlier, because that's the basis on which the IMF continually monitors and forms its opinions on its member countries. So to access the PLL, you also have to have the external position and market access must be there. So you must have a sustainable economic position. The capital account position must be dominated by private flows. There are a range of other criteria that are put forward in terms of access to that. Now, in terms of conditionalities, because again, IMF, the PLL loans are not tied to specific policy considerations or target. They are more focused around the performance of the economy. Whereas, for example, and we'll talk about it in a second, in terms of how the EFF is set up, it mandates in order to continually get your different disbursements, you have to undertake certain policy reforms and so on. Whereas the PLL isn't tied specifically the conditions. It's more about the general management of your economy in line with the criteria that I mentioned a few seconds ago in terms of the sustainability and your position and successful or relatively good reviews after the Article 4 consultations and so on. Yeah, and of course, the lending rate is also, of course, we like to believe that the IMF gives us relatively concessionary rates. So the market, the lending rate comprises, I mean, make no mistake, right now the IMF is some of the cheapest money in the market. So let's not kid ourselves with respect to that. Yeah, but in terms of the IMF, in terms of the lending rates, it's usually really the market determines special drawing rate, interest rate, which of course is determined based on any relationship with the country. And of course, there are other surcharges and so on that would then be worked into the framework. In terms of the duration, which is another important means by which it differs, it's 6 months, 6 months or 1 to 2 years. So you realize that's a relatively short program. In terms of the review, the 6 month arrangements are not subject to any reviews. And the 1 and 2 year arrangements are monitored through 6 year reviews by the IMF. Of course, I think Jamaica was a 2 year, if I remember correctly. Jamaica's PLL is a 2 year one, so you'd recognize there now that there would be 6 month reviews in terms of Jamaica, and the repayment period is usually around 3 to 5 years in terms of the repayment of the PLL. So that's the PLL and the extended fund facility now, which is what Barbados has just entered into again. It's basically aims to provide medium-term financial support to countries facing balance of payment difficulties, and it's designed for countries that require deeper policy adjustments. So you'd recognize in terms of the difference between the PLL, it requires for countries accessing the EFF It's countries that require deeper policy adjustments and longer term structural reforms. And we don't like to hear the word or the term structural reforms based on what we know of the IMF and its history, the Caribbean in particular, and Jamaica.
Code word for austere measures.
code word as it used to be. So these structural reforms that are typically associated with shorter term IMF programs. So Barbados's new program, it's 3 years. So the EFF program typically involves a multi-year arrangement between the IMF and the borrowing country, during which time the country implements a set of economic policies. In the case of Barbados, they're implementing what is known as BERT, which of course is basically the Barbados IMF program that they're looking to implement. Well, not that they're looking, that they're implementing. This is, we're now into BERT 2. We had BERT 1. Which is the first iteration of BERT, which was developed in conjunction with the IMF and supported and funded by the IMF. And so that's basically it. In terms of the duration, you'd realize that it's usually for a period of 3 years, but it may be approved for periods as long as 4 years if it takes that long to implement deep and sustained structural reforms, because the key then is based on the individual country's position. And the aim, of course, is to remedy the underlying causes of the balance of payment difficulties within the country's economy. And that's really the big difference. Then the repayment is usually over 4 to 10 years. And of course, given what I've said about the RSF and now about the PLL and the EFF, I'm hoping that our listeners are able to start to differentiate between the three.
Yeah, I think the interest rates are different as well as it relates to the PLL and the Extended Fund Facility.
Yeah, they tend to be, and particularly when it comes to the RSF now, which is trying to be as concessionary as possible, you'd recognize there now that there's even more leeway there with respect to that. I think one of the challenges now, interestingly, a lot of the focus now has not necessarily been on the interest rate in terms of the cost, but in terms of the surcharges. I was just reading a paper from some U.S. economists, for example, who have been criticizing Joseph Stiglitz as well, the Nobel Prize winner in economics, was criticizing the surcharge with respect to, which are separate from your principal and your interest payment, but you have surcharge as well based on when you draw down the money, based on other conditions, and the different facilities have different surcharges attached to it. And the criticism was that the IMF was making too much money off of these surcharges, and it was contributing to profitability of the organization, really on the backs of developing countries that are in need of financial assistance.
Okay, so I know you touched on this a little bit in mentioning conditionals as it relates to these programs. But in introducing this episode, I said that the move was announced that these countries would again reach out and receive this facility. There was a range of reactions. Some supported it and some was like, why are we going back to the IMF? And I think it stemmed from them either living through certain heavy IMF times, like in Jamaica in the 1980s, and I think 2014 to 2016, or some they have just read or heard about the IMF. So when they see the word IMF beside their coaches' names or government representatives, their mind always, you know, kind of goes south, because I guess they link IMF with heavy austerity. So how does this new program, the RSF, stand in relation to these older programs as it relates to austere measures? I know you've touched on it before, but could you like elaborate more?
Sure, and I think when I was sort of, in my mind now, I'm thinking about how do I answer this question. And I'm thinking of answering this question in terms of the IMF, how it's traditionally been operated and perceived, and how it's sort of transitioned. And I'll explain to you what I mean. So traditionally, the IMF philosophy has been market-oriented, pro-capitalist. There's been a strong bias towards free trade, and of course, the belief in the power of the price mechanism, the invisible hand, as economists like to say. And the philosophy influences, obviously, the approach to reform. So it's been paternalistic in nature, where the IMF comes in and basically gives you a scolding, or historically comes in and gives you a scolding and says, listen, this is what you really ought to be doing. These are the things that you need to do. And it imposes its philosophy on the world. That's been the perception. And countries that need to borrow, they've largely been seen as incompetent or careless whenever they get to this stage. And that's one of the reasons why there is that sort of apprehension about going to the IMF. No government really wants to go to the IMF now, because they're telling themselves the perception is that we fail as a government, and now we've had to go to the IMF as a lender of last resort, for example. But there's been a change of heart in terms of the IMF, and I'll talk to you about that very quickly. So the IMF emerged after the East Asian crisis in the 1990s as a greatly weakened institution. in regards to its credibility around the world, the adequacy of its own financial resources. And so the IMF was at its a low point in terms of history. So critics on both the right and the left, they rallied against institution, against the IMF's mission creep, where basically it came into the one thing, but it started to expand and expand its reach into other things. It's heavy-handedness, the ideological capture of governments and so on, and the dominance of the US and private financial interests in terms of how they operated with respect to the East Asian countries and so on at that particular point in time. But the IMF emerged after this particular crisis weakened, because one of the things that you saw is that you actually saw a situation where it's the number of loans and so on that it had on its books had gone to historic lows. There were very few countries that had IMF relations in terms of borrowing facilities and so on. I think it was literally a handful, if my memory serves me correct. And as a consequence of that, the IMF actually downsized its staff significantly. So it wasn't the IMF of old. And this was and so person there were questions about the future of the IMF in the early 2000s, for example. But then what happened? The global financial crisis occurred in 2008. And then the G20 nations, if you remember, they committed to $1.1 trillion in funds to combat the financial crisis. But of course, recognizing as these G20 countries, and of course, this push was led by the US, for example, they recognized the vulnerability of the IMF. And what did they do? They decided that this $1.1 trillion, $750 billion of this money for combating the financial crisis should be delivered to the IMF. What did that do? Puts the IMF back in center stage after what was a very difficult period in its history. So the IMF was then forced to reckon with a lot of the questions about whether its neoliberal agenda had been successful in terms of austerity and so on and so forth. All of that to say is that the IMF has basically had a change of heart with respect to a lot of things. So they're now more open, and I think there's been actually the former chief economist, Olivier Blanchard, actually led the sort of reform in terms of the IMF sort of becoming amenable to fiscal stimulus as opposed to austerity packages and so on and so forth. So we've seen that sort of transformation at the fund. And the approach to the IMF has changed significantly since that time. So they're now more accommodative, for example, and cooperative. And a good example of that is what we refer to as the homegrown Barbados Economic Recovery and Transformation, the BERT, which I mentioned earlier, and the 2013 Jamaica program, where there was a lot more collaboration and involvement of the government. So it wasn't a dictatorship necessarily. It was more a policy that was, you know, that was developed in a consultative way. And I say all that to say, yeah, exactly. So the approach of the IMF has changed in many respects. And with that now, you sort of recognize that, you know, it's trying to change its reputation. And because of that, now we're seeing the emergence of funds like the RSF, and we're seeing the PLL being extended to other countries and so. And that's in line with this new approach by the IMF. Not to say that the history isn't valid at all, but just to say that things have changed a bit.
Oh, but to many, it's still kind of hypocritical, because even though there are talks about, the overall talk about the RSF is that it's promoting environmental sustainability and economic resilience. But it has, or in some sense, continuing to promote environment extractive resource industries and resource exploitation. So could you explain how the RSF, if it does, would ensure that environmental concerns are considered in this economic policy or the economic frameworks the countries are adopting?
Sure. Well, I mean, the name would suggest that the aim is really to foster the start of climate change resilience that we would want to see coming forward. So as part of that, it's really the recognition that this has to happen, to put it quite frankly. So we spoke for some time about the negative aspects about the history of the IMF, which I just went through. And you know, these policies are there. But of course, what we need to acknowledge as well is that the IMF, the leadership is largely, and we could say basically, more or less determined by the developed countries. And to the extent that the G7s and so on, have sort of changed their stance or intensified their focus on climate change and resilience and have made it a priority, for example, for the EU and the US, at least ostensibly, then there is an expectation that the IMF, through this particular fund, is supposed to embody that sort of commitment to the environmental concerns and started maintaining. So the RSF really ought to be supporting and ensuring that it adheres to the whole, well, its mandate of protecting and against climate change and so and improving adaptation by Ray. And what it has been doing is, and the aim is to assess on a case-by-case basis to determine whether or not countries are facing or actually facing long-term climate vulnerabilities and whether the RSF is appropriate as an appropriate tool, because at the end of the day, it can't be money that is doled out to persons or to countries, I should say, that are not on track in terms of making sure that, you know, that they are looking to protect the environment, to safeguard against climate change, to improve their sustainability and to make sure you saw the climate improve their economy. Yes. So this is linked to the whole notion of progress as well. So each measure ought to be connected to the disbursement of the RSF. And that's really how they have to do it. They have to evaluate the countries. They have to make sure that as money is dispersed, that it's in line with the particular mandate of the particular facility. And that's how they get it done. Of course, there's always going to be that talk. But at the end of the day, I mentioned the change in terms of the disposition of the IMF to start to bring to the table that the IMF can change. So just we are changes as a matter of fact, because there was a time when fossil fuel and so on was commonplace. It still is, but in terms of the perception of it, and there was a lack of understanding in terms of the dangers. But now that has largely changed. And so the IMF, of course, we expect it to change with the science.
Yes. So you just spoke about what IMF has been doing will do as relates to the RSF. I think we can pivot a bit to what countries could do. Because, you know, historically, again, the neoliberal past of the IMF, their programs have normally benefited foreign investors and creditors more than the countries receiving the funds. And seeing that this fund is meant to heavily prop up sustainable economic policies, such as investing in renewable energies, and these industries are heavily dominated by businesses outside of the Caribbean, could you suggest ways in which Jamaica and Barbados could ensure that this new program benefits their own citizens and the economies at large?
I'll be honest with you, it's difficult because, like you said, a lot of these industries are dominated by external entities and corporations and so on that are really zoned in and focused on this particular element. And of course, with respect to the Caribbean, there's no shortage of brilliant minds, but in terms of where we are, there's a sort of gap there. So, but it really comes down to how the governments utilize the funds once drawn down, and the oversight and the review of the IMF to ensure that the policies and programs related to climate change and other resilience issues are enacted, and those are the ones where the focus is placed in terms of where the funding goes. So despite the relatively longer repayment window of the RSF, for example, the debt does have to be repaid. And so as a consequence, and it is debt, so as a consequence of that, the governments have to aim to position the country and its economy to put it in a place where in the medium term to long term, that it is able to generate the resources required to serve these obligations. Because it sounds all well and good to say, well, we have a 10-year moratorium in terms of repayment, and this is a 20-year facility. But when those payments kick in, the country and the government has to be in a position to do so. So how do you do that? You would want to obviously utilize the funds as carefully as possible in terms of the selection of your projects. Of course, you want to then have a criteria, and a big part of this has to do with your climate strategy and your climate resilience and sustainability strategy, which all countries at this stage in the game ought to have and should have. Yeah, so you want to carefully select your projects, and you want to make sure those are the ones that are benefiting the country, not necessarily. And that's sometimes a line that you have to straddle, because you want to spend the money sometimes in terms of, you know, projects that are going to more or less generate some returns immediately. But you have to realize, too, when it comes to climate change, a lot of these projects are not going to necessarily give you revenue. If you think, for example, I know in St. Vincent, which is where I'm from, the government has now spent so many ever millions of dollars in terms of some of the facilities at the shore, the shoreline protection and so on. That's not going to generate any income necessarily, but it protects the coastline, which indirectly contributes to tourism and the sustainable use of the land and the air. So all of those things. So the countries have to make that decision, and they have to decide in terms of the projects that are going to be most beneficial to the country, not just with a short-term focus, but also in terms of the resilience of the economy going forward. And when you think about a country like Jamaica and Barbados, which are obviously heavily tourism dependent, the sand and the sea and the sun, that's what we sell. And so the government therefore has to focus its energies in terms of preserving that economic model while at the same time trying to diversify. So, of course, a part of this is also trying to, as reasonably as possible, and this is notwithstanding the request or proposal guidelines and the tendered standards. Now, you want to have local companies doing the work. Yeah, you want to have as much as they are able to and as much as the particular proposals and the tendered standards and rules allow. I know there's some controversy in Jamaica with respect to that in terms of whether or not some money should be prioritized for small contractors and domestic contractors and so on. And there are some economists that would say, no, you should go to the one who's going to give you, you know, the most economic benefits and so. But I'm one of those who say sometimes you need to give the smaller companies or the domestic companies a little push. And of course, you want a climate-proof expenditure policy, and that's an important thing that governments ought to be doing. So you want to tag climate-related expenditure within the budget and set targets for increasing climate-related expenditure as a share of the public budget every year. You ought to be looking at that strategically. You shouldn't just be sprinkling in programs. It should be strategic. It should be targeted, and it should be something that's not that's well thought out. So, and you want to ensure that the climate-related expenditure in the budget is consistent with your national climate strategies, your nationally determined contributions, your NDCs, all of which exist under your climate resilient plans and framework. So those are the things I would say that the government really ought to be looking at least for now.
So you think focusing or pivoting towards ecotourism is a good strategy to go for?
Well, I don't think we should necessarily say pivot. I think we should incorporate. So, for example, Dominica has been doing a splendid job in terms of ecotourism. They've over the last year or so, their visitor count has increased significantly. I think it's more than increased more than 100% because of their focus and because of where they're going. So, the aim is not necessarily, I wouldn't say ecotourism, I would say sustainable tourism. Because to me, there are some things that we do now that we could continue to do, and there are other practices which are not sustainable in terms of our tourism product. And so to the extent that we are able to put forward a sustainable tourism product, then we are well on our way. But I wouldn't say to do a full-on pivot, it's just find ways of making the other aspects of our tourism product more sustainable.
So strategic investment, right? I hope, yes. You know, Prime Ministers Motley and Holness are paying attention. Now, many of us consider prime carnival season because, you know, we as Caribbean people, we're different, we're unique. But the IMF, you know, has been criticized for imposing economic policies that are not well suited to local context. Could you elaborate on how the RSF, if it does, will consider this like unique cultural and economic context of Jamaica and Barbados? Or is the burden on the country?
Well, I would say that this particular, and I'm looking forward, I know Jamaica Carnival just finished and Crop Over is coming up. So we are a people of culture. And so we are very different as much as we are similar. And in that respect, the facilities and these international lending institutions and so have to bear that in mind. And I think that's what they attempted to do with this RSF. It's specifically designed for the purpose and it's climate change strategy, which was published in 2021, the IMF actually referred to and identified 64 climate vulnerable countries along three criteria, including cumulative damage from natural disasters. And so what they've basically been doing is that they've been trying to build out a framework that takes into consideration vulnerability, the economic context, the development, the level of development within the countries, and so on and so forth, and trying to put together something that says, listen, these are the countries that perhaps should be given priority with respect to this RSF fund. Yeah. And another element of that is the incorporation of climate change risk into debt sustainability analysis, which is done periodically, obviously, by the IMF, to make sure that you're taking into consideration these economic contexts of these countries on an individual level. So it's really supposed to be designed to take these things and the unique vulnerability of the countries into consideration as it was structured. Of course, because it's a relatively new program, it's difficult for us to start to see how things are going to play out, you know, in terms of how it's going to go. But I would say that, and this is what a lot of the persons have been saying with respect to some of the international experts, and so they've been saying that, listen, this is a good step. This is something good in terms of looking at the developing countries, these small island states, and so on and so forth. But of course, there's been some criticism as well. So, for example, persons have been saying, why are we taking the SDR allocations that are being volunteered by these developed countries and funneling it through the IMF? Why not send that those SDR directly to, for example, the Green Climate Fund and the Adaptation Fund that obviously are giving grants and are giving other loans as well as grants and so on to the same calling for climate change and sustainability? Of course, that whole notion comes from the fact that there is a belief that the Green Climate Fund, for example, is going to be more accessible, it's going to give grants and so on and so forth. So as opposed to having a middleman in the form of the IMF, why not send it directly where some of these other funds have had a track record of taking the individual vulnerabilities into consideration? But again, like I said, this is something that we have to see how it plays out. To me, the intent is there, but we have to see how it's operationalized.
So what potential challenges or obstacles could the RSF face in achieving its goals?
Well, for me, there are a couple. I'll start with funding, but it shouldn't be a big issue because it's the IMF. But so far, the RSF resources that have been mobilized have come from voluntary contributions of IMF members with respect to their special joint, the SDRs. So they've basically been putting that up into the RSF fund for the IMF to then go on and make available via the RSF. Now, the challenge with that is obviously linked to the economic prosperity of these countries. So, for example, the countries that are putting forward their special drawing rights, they're putting them forward. Why? Because they don't need them currently. So to the extent to which these countries their own economic prospects may change, for example, then it may mean that they may start to rethink this allocation of their SDRs to this particular fund because they might well need it. For example, again, I don't think this is a significant problem that the IMF can't surmount, but just to say, based on its current funding model, that could prove something if the world goes into recession and some of these more developed countries have to then make some decisions. There's also going to be, and you mentioned it before, a challenge in terms of uptake from developing countries, and that's why the suggestion has come forward to sort of promulgate this fund through the Green Climate Fund, for example, as opposed to the IMF, because despite some recent shifts in the perceived reputation of the IMF, it is still negatively regarded by many developing countries, so much so that their leaders in some of these developing countries would rather let their economies decline and their progress to climate change resilience sort of inch along rather than approach the fund. That is the reality of it. There is this reputation that remains. Of course, I know, for example, some economists have been saying that the Bahamas, for example, ought to approach the IMF for some funding based on its current fiscal position. Similar thing for Antigua, similar thing for some of the other countries in the Caribbean where these prime ministers say, listen, we're not going back to the fund. I remember, we're not going back there. It's something that we're not interested in doing because of the political risk associated with going to the IMF. So that's a challenge that they're going to have to surmount as well. Tied to that is the whole notion of the fear of debt. And of course, like we said, at the end of the day, whether you're paying it back in 5 years, 10 years, it's still debt. So notwithstanding the relatively generous terms of the RSF, for example, it is still at the end of the day a debt or a loan which has implications for the country in terms of its debt to GDP ratio and other things like that. And so countries are obviously going to think twice about that sort of approach to the IMF. And of course, finally, what I noted also is the timing of the disbursements. Should they be front or back loaded? And it's going to be a challenge for the IMF to sort of straddle that line. I say that because, for example, climate change mitigation adoption costs are high, as we know. And this often means that that it requires front-loaded access to credit. So you have the IMF may need to give out a lot of money in the early stages in order to get some of these projects off the ground in terms of the disbursement. So that might be required, right? But however, if you've given a country the bulk of the money under the loan, then your leverage to secure the reforms is start to diminish. Because if I've gotten almost all the money that I'm going to borrow from you, you then can come and tell me, or let me not put it that way, perhaps then my inclination to listen to you in terms of these reforms which you would have me implement is diminished somewhat by virtue of the fact that I now have most of the money. But again, because of how some of these climate change projects are set up, sometimes it requires a front-loaded approach in terms of the disbursements. And I think that's going to be a challenge, as well as time, for example. So some of these projects takes time to identify. You have to study. It takes time to do this study and to complete it. And of course, it takes time to put forward solutions. And to the extent that climate change is progressing at the rate at which it's becoming sort of deleterious, that we become more concerned almost every day, then, you know, it might be a situation where the horse has already left the stable, as we would say colloquially. Yeah. So those are the concerns that I think are issues there. So, and there's also the need for regulatory and supervisory frameworks to start to better assess the climate-related financial structure of these countries, and also to make sure that they have proper climate finance strategies, as well as climate change and resilience strategies as well. Because at this stage of the game, I've looked at some of these strategies by some countries. Some of them are outdated, as a matter of fact, and are in need of update, for example. And those are also potentially important impediments to this particular facility achieving its objectives.
So I know you were speaking about Bahamas, and Bahamas are wanting to go to the IMF. Is the like
not wanting to suggested persons have suggested that they should. The government is not interested.
So yeah, so I'm saying, isn't the Caribbean Development Bank an option instead of the IMF?
Yeah, well, the difference with the Caribbean Development Bank is the Caribbean Development tends to be project oriented, for example. So you want to do a project, you want to build some infrastructure and so on and so forth. That's more of the wheelhouse of the Caribbean Development Bank. Of course, like the IMF now is more for structural changes within your economy and a longer term outlook. But the CDB, for example, is more, I shouldn't say more, some persons might argue differently, but to me, when, you know, for example, St. Vincent, now they're building a port, a large part of that is coming from collaboration with the CDB and so on and so forth. They're doing other things, but to me, it's a lot, and they're trying to change their focus now. But for me, it's traditionally been more project oriented rather than, you know, dealing with longer term fiscal and structural issues.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that. So the IMF, as we've been dishing out here, has been a big play in our histories. Could you see, as an economist, could you see a Caribbean without the IMF, a post-IMF Caribbean?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the extent to which we'd want the post-Caribbean IMF from the perspective of, you know, the resources that we require to in terms of bringing our economies forward. I think our Caribbean space benefits, and not to say it can't be replaced by another entity. For example, in terms of the Article 4 consultations, those are really good resources to me as an economist. The IMF comes in on an annual basis, continuous engagement with the government in terms of you know, fiscal and monetary policy and so on, the sort of collaborations that you have. And by and large, you know, that's the extent of the relationship between most and of course, the special draw rights, which would then draw down if you need it. But that's the extent of the relationship of most Caribbean countries in terms of, you know, Caribbean countries don't typically have an EFF or a PLL on the books as a habitual thing. It's more so in terms of, you know, collaborations and technical expertise and so, which I think are critical for example, CARTAC, which is the Caribbean arm of the IMF in terms of its technical support and assistance to Caribbean countries. That's been very important in terms of development of our economic frameworks and our policy frameworks in the Caribbean space. So from that perspective, I think the IMF continues to be useful, even with respect to lending, for example. Like I said, right now the IMF is some of the cheapest money on the market. Of course, we know global interest rates are increasing. So if you're looking at interest rates that are really high globally, but the IMF coming in and lending you at 2%, then obviously that bodes well for you. We saw what it's doing for Barbados in terms of its international reserves, for example. So those things are important ways which the government is able to secure itself without incurring massive amounts of debt. Compromising its debt sustainability or its debt repayment as well. So those are some of the challenges we have. I think there continues to be a role for the IMF. I think the IMF just needs to continue in terms of its reform and in terms of the collaborative work that it would do, as opposed to coming in with this heavy-handed approach, which I think by and large is changing. But I don't know. I mean, obviously, self-sufficiency is always good. So if we could establish our own fund, and we've tried to do that, as you know, with the CARICOM Development Fund, but there continues to be issues with that in terms of who pays, the extent to which they pay, and so on and so forth. So why we would like to have a situation where we could depend on ourselves and maybe depend on other international agencies other than the IMF, I think right now it's serving its purpose, and it just needs to continue along with its reforms and its collaboration. And simultaneously, we as Caribbean countries need to put in place our own facilities and improve the ones that we do have to make sure that we're able to treat with these same challenges that are only going to be exacerbated in terms of climate change and so. But I think right now the IMF is doing exactly what it needs to be doing. And so we ought to collaborate with them while building our own resilience and working on our own institutions from a regional perspective.
So you think there's like a place for the for CARICOM in the reform of IMF, basically? Or there should be a place for CARICOM.
And I think for example, Prime Minister Mia Martin is leading the charge with the Bridgetown Initiative and other
yes.
Other ideas that she's been putting forward in terms of how these international finance, because I mean, when we think about the history of these organizations in terms of how they come about at the Bretton Woods and so on, we recognize that the purpose for which they were created it's dated in many respects. And so the financing model has to be changed with the times and to incorporate a broader cross-section of views from developing countries and small island states and so on and so forth. So I think the Caribbean, particularly because we're on the front line, we have a bloc that's on the front line in terms of the impact of climate change and so on, and our needs going forward with it. If there isn't a place, we have to make a place and we have to push the agenda. Because it's critical that the voice, and that's why we're always stronger together as a region and as a bloc. And when we come together as those 15 voices of CARICOM, and if you add the DR and so on, you'd recognize that we do have a say, and we ought to make sure that our voices are heard.
Thank you for your insight, Dr. Delano, and your time. I know we're in final season, and you said you were at you're at UWE right now. So thank you for taking time out of your business schedule to come with to come and talk to us.
Man, for sure, man. Thank you for the invitation. And I really enjoyed the discussion. And I really enjoyed the podcast as well. This is one of those podcasts that this is a podcaster's podcast as well as one for the general public as well. So I really enjoyed the content that you guys put out.
Yeah, we'll try to break down every tenement, in the yard so they can hold their governments accountable. This has been another episode of Checkmate by Tenement Yard Media. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at tenementyard_, or check out our website at www.tenementyardmedia.com. And remember to stop by a lawyer and a policy analyst walk into a bar with our guest, Dr. Delano, and attorney at law, Jadrick Cummings.